Well, I think it's close enough, so we'll go ahead and get started. Saint Benedict said that you should pray often, but keep your prayers short. And so I'm going to honor that today, and with this prayer that seems appropriate for what the monastic tradition sought to achieve, that is, a perpetual awareness of the presence of God. God be in my head and in my understanding. God be in my eyes and in my looking. God be in my mouth and in my speaking. God be in my heart and in my thinking. God be at mine end and at my departing. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Okay, well, thank you guys for coming. I guess the good thing about this time, well, everybody's hungry, I know, but at 2 o'clock, it's going to be hard probably to stay awake after lunch. So, well, here's what I would like to try to accomplish today in the short time we have. It's a fairly ambitious goal. I want to do a high-level overview of the origin and history of monasticism, at least up to a particular time frame when monasticism really establishes itself in the English Isles. And I'll try to do a real high-level overview about the rest of the history of monasticism. We can't cover it all or in any detail, however. And then I'd like to talk briefly about the monastic influence on Anglican spirituality and then how the monastic idea might be relevant to us today. I can always count on my coworkers to give me great introductions to some of these talks that I occasionally have to give, and they didn't let me down again this time. They know about my sort of alter ego here at the church, and they'll frequently ask me questions, and it makes for some interesting conversation. A few weeks ago, one asked me what was going on at the church lately, and I told him, well, I was getting ready to give this presentation. And he said, oh, what are you going to be talking about? And I said, monasticism. And he kind of looked at me and squinched up his face, and I could tell he was a little bit bothered, and I fully anticipating some kind of, you know, anti-Catholic rant about monasticism being works righteousness or something. And he blurted out, what is that? He had no idea what monasticism was. And then another coworker standing there next to us said, oh, good, for a second I thought you said masochism. Well, that was kind of awkward. So if there's any moral to this story, when you use the word monasticism, make sure you enunciate it correctly. You don't want to go around saying you're very into monasticism or you're very interested in monasticism and have people misinterpret what you're talking about. I was first exposed to monasticism as a very zealous young evangelical in the early 90s. I was taking classes at Dallas Baptist University, and I was very interested in philosophy at the time. But Dallas Baptist only had 3 or 4 philosophy classes, and once I exhausted that, I went over to the University of Dallas to take some more philosophy classes. They had a whole philosophy department there. A very good one, by the way. And the University of Dallas is Roman Catholic. Well, I didn't know this when I started out there, but there is a monastery across the street, a Cistercian monastery. They're a teaching order. They run the Cistercian school there, and they're involved in teaching at the university and in various other academic pursuits. So it's not uncommon to see a Cistercian monk in his robes, you know, shooting out across the quad. Well, I didn't really have much of an understanding of what monasticism was. I sort of had the Protestant line, but not much else. But as I spent several years there, and I eventually did a master's degree at University of Dallas in medieval history and philosophy, I got to spend time with the monks, get to know some of them, spend time over at their abbey. And I was struck by, it was not what I had expected. These men were very warm and affable. They had a very authentic piety about them that I just was not—I had not experienced or seen before. They were very humble, And I was always very struck by that. And having conversations with them about what monasticism was, it was not what I had been led to believe. You know, for example, you know, as a good Protestant, you think these guys are trying to earn their salvation or something, trying to merit God's favor. And I confronted them about that and asked them, and they thought that was crazy talk. You know, of course you can't do that. So anyway, it was a very interesting experience, and it's kind of put in me an interest in monasticism that I've had for many years. But my friend's question, or my coworker's question, what is monasticism, is a good place to start. It's really not an easy question to answer because there are many different expressions of monasticism in history. It comes from the word monos, which means solitary, which is kind of interesting because when most of us think of monasticism today, we think of monks living together in a community, but the actual word monasticism doesn't mean that. It means solitary. But if you're looking for an overall high-level definition, we can go with monasticism as a structured and or ascetic approach to the Christian life. But what does that really tell us? In reality, many monastic movements are very ascetic, but not very structured. And then there are monastic movements that are very structured, but not very ascetic. And there's everything in between. Let's skip this one. Come back to that later. When we go back into history, there are a number of pre-Christian predecessors to monasticism we could look at. Of course, we're all familiar with Eastern religions, Buddhist monks. You know, they can do a lot of cool things. You may have seen them on TV flipping and doing martial arts. Is there an Old Testament precedent for monasticism? That's sort of an open question. It depends on how you interpret certain individuals. There is this idea of the Nazirite vow. You may have heard of this. Does anybody know what that is? Yes. Someone raise their hand right there. Someone take it. Going once. Yeah, some think Samson had taken a Nazirite vow. Right, don't drink wine. It was sort of an ascetic commitment. But they weren't isolated, you know. They lived in the community with their families and whatnot. And then you have the example of Elisha and Elijah, who seemed to live some sort of ascetic existence. There are the Essenes. You may have heard of these guys. They're associated with the Qumran community off the Dead Sea, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. And they were a sort of mystical Jewish sect from the 2nd century to the 1st century AD. Many think that John the Baptist may have been an Essene or somehow affiliated with them. There's really no proof either way. Of course, we have this image of John the Baptist eating locusts and honey and living in the wilderness. It seems very ascetic. And there's something called a group called the Therapeutai, and these were recorded for our. We learn about them from a Jewish writer called Philo, who lived in Alexandria, and they apparently existed in Egypt, and may have been related to the Essenes in some way. And some scholars think that there is some connection to their influence in later Egyptian monasticism as it would develop. Well, how about Christian monasticism? Where did that come from? Well, probably not what happened, but, and I know that's stupid and silly, I felt compelled to throw it in there. Well, when we look to the history to look for Christian monasticism, its origin, we see there is this monastic impulse in the early church. Or an ascetic impulse, not necessarily monastic, an ascetic impulse. We see a lot of early believers committing themselves to celibacy, for example, or some other ascetic form of lifestyle. And what we have as an example here is Saint Thecla. She's little known, but apparently she may have been a follower of Paul the Apostle, and she committed herself to a chastity and led a somewhat ascetic life. But these early ascetics did not separate themselves from the community. They still lived in their communities, lived with their families, and practiced various ascetic disciplines. But then in the 4th century, we see something different occurs. a lot of people, particularly in and around Egypt, start withdrawing to the desert. And this is where we get the word anchorite from. It's the idea is to withdraw. And they were very much committed to a rigorous ascesis, or struggle and self-denial, which is where we get the word ascetic from. And it's interesting to note that this monasticism historically has been a lay movement. Most monks are not priests, or historically that has been the case. Now today, a lot of the monasteries, Catholic monasteries, for example, you will have a lot of the monks are ordained, but that historically was not generally the case. So what happened here? You know, historians look at this, and they give several different explanations. The most common theory is that this flight to the desert was some form of protest movement. What could they be protesting in the 4th century? Anybody have any ideas? Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It seems that if they were moving to the desert, they were protesting the way of the world and trying to get away from.
Yeah, okay, well, both of those are right, I think. I think both of you hit the nail on the head. When historians look at what's going on in the 4th century, well, what happened at the very beginning of the 4th century? You had this man, Constantine. At this time, the Roman Empire had been divided into two halves. And this happened with the Emperor Diocletian, who was also responsible for one of the harshest outbreaks of persecutions against Christians. Well, after Diocletian left the scene, you had the empire permanently divided, essentially, and people started fighting over it. You know, make a long story short, Constantine emerges as the victor over the western half of the empire. His mother, Monica, was a Christian. We don't know how influential she was on him early on. But he was a pagan, allegedly, before the Battle of Milvian Bridge. You may have heard the story. He has this vision, in this sign, conquer. And so he had all his army put this symbol, which is some sort of Christian symbol, we don't know what, on their shields, and they were victorious. And he will go on to issue the Edict of Toleration. Doesn't make Christianity the official religion yet. That'll happen a century later, almost, under Theodosius. But you have the emergence, under Constantine, of this imperial church. Suddenly, you know, Christianity has gone from a sect, a persecuted sect, to kind of, you know, a chic religion, as it were, the religion of the empire. When you go to apply for a job in the emperor, you want to check that box that you're a Christian. And so what happens here is a sort of watering down of Christianity, or at least viewed by many, you know. There were those people, the martyrs and the confessors, the people during the persecution times, they were looked upon as the athletes of God, these people who took their faith to the extreme. Suddenly you don't have that anymore in the imperial church. So what do you do? Well, you flock to the desert. So what is the question monasticism is trying to answer? What are they seeking to do? Monasticism seeks a practical answer to the paradoxical question of how can one be in the world but not of the world? How are we to take up our cross and to follow Jesus daily? And we see many scriptures that talk about that we are not of the world. For example, they, Jesus' followers, are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind. Do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? And do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh and the desires of the eyes and the pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world. And the world is passing away along with its desires, but whoever does the will of God abides forever. Pretty strong language. The world doesn't seem like a very good place, a very desirable place. So in a sense, monasticism emerges as the ultimate Christian counterculture movement. Your bishop mentioned this yesterday, that as Christians, we are sort of a counterculture movement. Well, monasticism is almost a counterculture movement within Christianity. And we all are familiar with the counterculture movement of the 60s. But these guys had nothing on these guys, as far as being counterculture. Now, it is interesting to note, if you take off these black habits and put these guys in tie-dye shirts, they look like hippies or a backup band for ZZ Top or something. Well, we can... There are many different forms of monasticism we mentioned earlier. There are at least three major divisions. There's the eremitical or desert monasticism. The word for desert, eremos, is where we get the word hermit from. Then you have the cenobitic, which basically means common life. And then there was a sort of in-between version known as skete, may have emerged in the Scetus Valley in Egypt. And this is referred to as semi-eremitical monasticism. You could perhaps in some cases easily refer to it as semi-cenobitic as well. So these categories are not hard and fast, but they're the general categories when you read monastic literature that they will use when discussing it. Incidentally, this is a shot, I don't know if you can see it, from Anthony's cave in the Egyptian desert. How many of you would like to live there? Yeah. So let's look a little bit at Eastern eremitical monasticism. It was a new asceticism of withdrawal, as we had mentioned. And one of the most famous individuals here was St. Anthony the Great. He is often called the father of monasticism. And we know about Anthony from St. Athanasius, who you're probably hearing a lot about this week. He wrote a hagiography of St. Anthony called The Life of St. Anthony, and this became like a New York Times bestseller in the early church. So Anthony became famous from this. Now, hagiography is a genre of literature. I don't know if you're familiar with this. It's pretty wild stuff. It's not biography like we think of it. It's pretty loose with a lot of the facts. You can get some history from it, but it's almost like a spiritual metaphor. In these hagiographies, they're wanting to inspire people to pious deeds and the spiritual life. So they're very interesting. And we have in the life of Saint Anthony, Anthony struggling with the devil, literally. So Anthony is a curious figure. He apparently had some means, but he heard the passage where Jesus tells the rich young ruler to sell all you have and give it to the poor and follow me. And so he did that literally and then fled to the desert. He apparently one time left the desert to seek martyrdom. He couldn't get himself martyred and returned to the desert. And he thought he was the first to do this, this withdrawal to the desert. But he had a vision, apparently, or at least St. Jerome records this. There was another one, actually, who was doing it before him. This was Paul of Thebes. And apparently they did have occasion to meet each other. And it was a humbling experience for St. Anthony. But with this eremitical movement, you see a lot of extreme asceticism. It's characterized by severe fasting, abstinence, exposure, sleep deprivation, and isolation. And one of the more odd examples of this is the Stylite movement, started by Simeon the Stylite, probably. This is a guy who built himself a pillar and lived on top of it for 40 years, give or take. And people would keep coming out and seeing him, and so he'd keep building the pillar higher and higher. Apparently at his death it was some 40 feet high, and he is alleged to have lived there for 40 years. And there's something called, I'll call it the hermit's curse. I didn't know what else to call it. Maybe the irony of hermits. But when we see the same problem with St. Anthony. A lot of these desert hermits, they go to the desert. They want to withdraw from society, yet people follow them out there. It became like a tourism industry. These guys became, you know, famous. People wanted to see them. It was believed that they had a spiritual energy. They would bring sick people to them. They believed that they could give blessings and cure people and work miracles. The fact that so many people would flock to these desert hermits led many of them to live in this general vicinity. And this was called a lavra, which means it's Greek for path. So they lived isolated in isolated cells or caves, but there'd be a path between them, and they might gather together for common worship. And so you sort of see the emergence here of that semi-eremitical movement, whether they're still living like desert hermits, but they're loosely affiliated with each other. So when you look at the history of asceticism, the scholars will talk, there's basically heretical and orthodox asceticism. Heretical is characterized by the Gnostics. I think Bishop Sutton talked about these yesterday, the Manichaean, people like this. They seem to be influenced by Greek philosophy, particularly a form of philosophy we call today Neoplatonism. And Neoplatonism, basically, in essence, Neoplatonism, you had the spiritual reality, which was good, the most pure. Anything that derivated from the spirit to more of material existence was evil. The further you got away from pure spirit, the more you were into the realm of evil. Then you have the orthodox asceticism. And these guys were characterized often by a simplistic hermeneutic, a simplistic interpretation of the Bible. For example, St. Anthony hearing that parable of Jesus and selling everything and literally taking off to the desert. They rejected dualism, but yet they seem to have been influenced by it. Even though they didn't embrace it intellectually, this whole dualistic kind of view of matter and the spirit sort of imbibed the ethos, if you will, of the day. And they were also motivated by what they call the desert theology of the Old Testament. So what do you see with the Israelites before they enter the Holy Land? What do? They wander in the Egyptian desert for 40 years. What does Jesus do before he starts his public ministry? He goes to the Judean desert for 40 days. And so they saw this as an example for them to follow. And maybe, I think one application for us, from these guys, is that they took sin seriously. How many Christians today really take sin seriously and really seek to struggle against it and fight against it? Let's say a few words about the rise of Cenobitic monasticism. Pachomius was one of the first to do this. He was an ex-soldier. And he gathered monks into large communities, almost like a military camp. And there was an emphasis on work, obedience to a superior, but they had little spiritual direction. Basil the Great is one of the next stages in communal monasticism. And instead of these large communities, these military camps that Pachomius had, he broke them up into smaller, more familial communities of maybe 12 monks. And they had spiritual direction under a superior, and they engaged in common prayer and devotion to Scripture, and it was less ascetically rigorous. Pachomius thought that communal monasticism was a step to ascetic or desert monasticism. Basil, however, rejected the hermit movement and thought that this communal monasticism was the highest form. And here's a great quote from him. The solitary life has one aim, the service of the needs of the individual. But this is plainly in conflict with the law of love. The Lord, for the greatness of his love of men, was not content with teaching the word only, but that accurately and clearly he might give us a pattern of humility in the perfection of love. He girded himself and washed the feet of the disciples in person. Whose feet, then, wilt thou wash? Whom wilt thou care for? In comparison with whom wilt thou be last? If thou livest by thyself. It's a great quote. And notice he connects here this communal living with humility and the perfection of love. This will be a common monastic theme. Living in community brings about humility and is necessary if you were to learn how to love. So monasticism will continue to move west. St. Martin of Tours may have been the first person to found a monastery in Gaul. He was a converted Roman soldier, and he founded a semi-eremitical colony of hermits there. So he's basically bringing Egyptian monasticism to the west, to modern-day France. There's a fascinating story about St. Martin of Tours. Maybe some of you have heard this. He was, as a soldier, was going into a Roman town, and he saw this beggar on the side of the road, freezing. And so St. Martin of Tours took his cloak and cut it in two, as we see here in the stained glass image, and gave it to this beggar. a half of his cloak. Well, that night he had a dream or a vision, and the beggar was Christ, and he had given half his cloak to Christ. And so St. Martin will go ahead and become a monk eventually. And this cloak, the half the cloak that he kept, became sort of a relic for the Frankish kings. And just sort of an interesting footnote here, they would take it with them when they go to battle, and they built churches around it. This became known as the Capella, or the Little Cloak, or the place of the Little Cloak. And someone, a monk or a priest who resided over this, became known as a Capellan. And this is where we get the word for chaplain and chapel. John Cassian, Father John spoke about him yesterday. He founded a number of Cenobitic monasteries in Gaul and was responsible for penning monastic theology, writing some, serious theology about the monastic life. Most of the monks early on, they were not scholars, they were not academics, they were not learned. John Cassian is an early exception to this. He's rather controversial because he was accused of semi-Pelagianism during his day, and the reformers picked up on that. And because he was so influential in monasticism as a theological basis for a lot of it, many at the Reformation associated monasticism with his semi-Pelagianism. However, as I understand, I'm no Cassian scholar, but I believe this is largely refuted now that he was a semi-Pelagian. So, but we'll move on. We're talking about councils and creeds here, and I just wanted to throw this slide up. By 451, the Fourth Council of Chalcedon, or the Fourth Ecumenical Council at Chalcedon, monasticism had become so ingrained in the life of the church that the council felt the need to address it or to legislate it. And so they did pass various canons, regulate monastic life. And of course, this would become something of a debate in later medieval history. Who is going to control the monasteries? If something known as the investiture controversy will arise, where there's a great struggles between secular rulers and the bishops over who controls church property, who appoints bishops and abbots and so forth. Well, so this is the situation you have in the 6th century. Western half the empire has collapsed. It's ruled by all these Germanic kingdoms. And it's quite a mess, actually. But out of this chaos will emerge one of the most significant developments in the history of Western monasticism, and that is the Benedictine idea. St. Benedict of Nursia started out as a hermit. He became so popular that a group of monks convinced him to be their abbot. Well, when he agreed, and he started trying to impose order on these monks, and they decided they didn't like that, so they sought to poison him. Well, he wisely left that group, but he was convinced at this point that the cenobitic or communal life was superior, and he would go on to found a number of monasteries. But he's most famous for this rule he wrote. We call it Benedict's Rule, the Rule of St. Benedict. And in there he writes, "We are about to open a school for God's service in which we hope nothing harsh or oppressive will be directed." He calls it his Little Rule for Beginners. It's 73 chapters. It's not very long. And it regulates the spiritual life, both the spiritual life and the administration of the abbey. You hear a lot about the evangelical councils, that these vows that monks would take. Poverty, chastity, and obedience, right? Well, there's actually some debate whether how many monks really took those exact vows. But in Benedict's Rule, it does call for the monks to take these three vows: obedience, stability, and conversion of life. Chastity and poverty are sort of implied in there. There's a strong focus on humility. That's actually the longest chapter in Benedict's Rule, is a chapter on humility. They were to spend a lot of their time in silence. They were to spend a lot of time in work as well. Work was viewed as spiritually efficacious. And it was, as we've already looked at, characterized by moderation. But the most significant thing about Benedict's Rule is the divine office, or the Opus Dei. It was to be a life ordered around prayer. They divided prayer into eight different times a day. And they were also very focused on Scripture. He writes in his rule, what page or word of the Bible is not a perfect rule for temporal life? And they would go through all 150 Psalms in a week. And he thought this was kind of lazy, actually, because the Desert Fathers went through all 150 in a day. And they engaged in what's called lecto divina, or holy reading. They spent a lot of time reading Scriptures. This is not reading for knowledge or facts, but sort of a prayerful reading of the Scriptures and the Desert Fathers, sort of a ruminating, digesting on it. So, you have Benedictine monasticism becoming established in the West, and Benedict's rule become the standard moving forward for Western monasticism. But up on the British Isles, you have a new development, or a different development. It's not new, it's actually ancient. Christianity arrived in the British Isles fairly early. We're not exactly certain when. It seems fairly certain that by the second century, the mid-second century, Christians were in Britain. Of course, the most famous development here early on is St. Patrick, and we're probably all familiar with his story. He was, you know, abducted by pirates, sold into slavery into Ireland. He eventually escaped. He went to St. Martin's Monastery in Gaul, became a monastic, and eventually returns to Ireland. And he was not the first to take the gospel to the Irish. There are others before, but he appears to have been the most successful. And we see within 150 years, you can see this map, how many monasteries dotted Ireland. And these are the ones they know about. Ireland became a land of monasticism in a way that few other places did. And even though he brings the sort of semi-eremitical monastic, that Patrick brings this type of desert monasticism to Ireland, it develops differently there. And developed along clan organization. And there was no episcopal organization. It was abbot-ruled. You see here this little image of the village. A lot of these monasteries were walled villages, essentially. You had married monks, apparently. It could be extremely ascetic. Father John talked yesterday about the origin of the penitential system coming from the Irish monasticism. And one of their forms of penance was this idea of wandering. You may have heard of the term white monasticism. They had this sort of color-coded monasticism. Red monasticism is dying a martyr. Green was going and becoming a hermit. White was going out there and wandering around wherever God led you. Of course, they had a love of learning, and the Irish monastic schools became the best in Europe in the 7th century. Wandering monks. Here's interesting how this works. So Patrick takes the gospel to Ireland in 432. In 563, you have Columba founding Iona off the Scottish coast. He takes the gospel to Scotland, Irish monasticism that develops. Then you have Columbanus takes the gospel from Ireland back to the continent. Then you have this development in around 597 where St. Augustine brings Catholic monasticism sent by St. Gregory the Great. And I would say more about that, but we're running low on time, so I'll go ahead and push forward. Then Paulinus, one of Augustine's followers, and this is not St. Augustine of the 4th century, this is Augustine of Canterbury, just to be clear. Paulinus would found a monastery in York. Then you have Aidan, St. Aidan, you probably heard a lot of these names, takes Celtic monasticism and founds it on the east coast there, Lindisfarne. So you see what's happening here. You have Celtic monasticism going north, coming south. Then you have Catholic monasticism coming up, going north. Well, we're headed for a smackdown of monasticism, which occurs in Whitby at 664. And I'm assuming most of you are rather familiar with this. We won't belabor it. So they have the synod at Whitby, and we won't go into the details of the issues, but in short, the Roman tradition wins out over the Celtic. But there's really a unique fusion of these two forms of monasticism. And this leads to the Northumbrian Renaissance, or the golden age of Christianity in England in the 7th and 8th century. You have the illuminated manuscripts that emerge, the transmission, preservation of classical learning. You have Bede's ecclesiastical history. And you have the strong missionary fervor. These Celtic, Catholic, fused monks will now take the gospel into Germany, the Germanic barbarians, and proceed to convert them. And they will were critical in founding this relationship between the emerging Carolingian Empire, that's the empire that would become France, essentially, in the Middle Ages, and the Catholic, the papacy. So the subsequent history of monasticism is a history of monastic renewal, reform, and change. The Vikings will attack in the 8th century, or beginning of the 9th century, and basically wipe out Christianity on England. By the 10th century, you have St. Dunstan, and there's a renewal of monasticism and Christianity. And it's Benedictine monasticism that is basically renews England, which is maybe significant for later on. You will have this pattern of decline and reform throughout the history of monasticism. Monasticisms were behind many reform movements in the history of the church up until the Reformation. And you'll have a lot of change occur. By the 11th and 12th centuries, monasticism is starting to change. You have the emergence of these military orders. Well, what you see happening is a move from the contemplative life to the active life. In other words, you don't have to be cloistered in a monastery to be pious. You can get out there in the world and do things. And, of course, we have the emergence of the mendicant or friars, you know, the Franciscans and the Dominicans. They don't live in cloisters. They're out among the people, preaching, teaching, and serving. You know, of course, you have the odd development of the military orders. These are the Knights Templar or the Knights Hospitallers. These guys who were monks, but they were warriors. I think it's kind of cool in a way. Actually, I was doing a lot of research on this back in the day. So the historical significance of monasticism, I'm not going to go all these points, but from a historical perspective, monasticism is incredibly significant to the history of Western civilization. Its role is incalculable. But more than just all these historical developments behind it, I think one of the other critical areas is what it did for the English church spiritually. And Anglicanism has historically had a unique relationship with monasticism. And we've already seen that English Christianity had a uniquely monastic history. Many English bishops were monks. And this was not common in the West, generally. It is in the East. The Eastern Church gets their bishops from the monastery. And you have the unique development of the English cathedral priory. A lot of the cathedrals in England actually had these monastic priories associated with them. I think at one time there were as many as 50%. Benedictine monk and monastic scholar Robert Hale says that Anglicanism, in insisting on its continuity with Norman, Anglo-Saxon, and Celtic Christianity, all decisively characterized by the monastic experience, realizes that the formative years for the development of its spirituality, liturgy, and theology and polity were monastic years. Well, wait a minute. Not so fast, Deacon Darrell. How can you say that Anglicanism is some kind of, you know, monastic type movement when at the Reformation you have Henry VIII dissolve the monasteries with the Acts of Suppression? In 1536, you had 800 plus monasteries and nunneries and so forth in England. By 1541, there were zero. So how can Anglicanism be uniquely monastic when they shut down all the monasteries during the English Reformation? The answer to that is the Book of Common Prayer. The Book of Common Prayer is a reflection of monastic spirituality. The whole nation was to be a monastic-like community, united in common prayer. But it was not just any type of monasticism. What was really influential in England and in the prayer book tradition was this Benedictine form of monasticism that had established itself in the 8th century. There's an interesting quote on the Benedictine order in the Catholic Encyclopedia. It was said that St. Benedict seemed to have taken possession of the country as his home, as his own. Nowhere did the order link itself so intimately with the people and institutions, secular as well as religious, as in England. And then Martin Thornton, who's wrote the classic text on English spirituality, has this great quote. Before the conquest, England was known as the land of the Benedictines. In spiritual theology, rather than monastic order, I think it still is. Thornton goes on to discuss these several areas where the prayer book and the role of Saint Benedict influence each other. The threefold rule, that is office, Eucharist, and personal devotion. Forming a habitual recollection of the presence of God. We'll talk more about that here briefly in just a minute. An emphasis on familial community and a balanced practical asceticism. I just want to say a few comments about the threefold rule, and I think you've already probably heard this this week.
You have until 15 till.
15 till, great. Thank you, sir. You guys doing okay? Okay. We'll charge on then. The divine office, so the divine office in the Benedict's rule was condensed. The eight offices were condensed in the two offices we have of morning and evening prayer. How many of you knew that when you're praying morning and evening prayer, you're being monastic? You guys knew this? So what am I even here talking for, right? There's an interesting historical footnote to Benedict and Cranmer. St. Benedict died on March 21st, 543. Thomas Cranmer was martyred on March 21st. It's kind of odd that Welby, the new Archbishop of Canterbury, is his name Justin Welby? He was enthroned just this last March, on March 21st, and he paid homage to both Benedict and Cranmer as being critical to the Anglican tradition. So, let's move on. How is monasticism relevant to us today? Well, back to that question we asked earlier. How can we be in the world but not of the world today? You know, most of us are not going to go join a monastery. What do we do? How can we apply this to our lives? I think there's several areas the history of monasticism or monasticism spirituality can inform our own faith today. Many people, when they talk about monasticism, they say it's escapism. Now think about that. That's an odd charge, is it? Especially for a Christian to make. I had a Christian one time tell me, I was telling him about the monks I hung out with, the Cistercian Abbey, and he thought that was kind of weird and that they were just trying to run away from reality. But what is reality? I mean, this question, what is really real? I mean, are the lives we lead, the secular lives we lead, of consumerism, materialism, pursuing pleasure, indulgence, is that reality? Maybe the monks have it right. Maybe there's a higher reality that we can aspire to. And of course, what discussion on monasticism would be complete without a reference to the Matrix? How many of you saw the Matrix? Just show of hands real quick. So almost everybody. Okay, so I don't have to get into much background on this. There's this great scene, and I actually had a video of it. I couldn't get it to play, so unfortunately I had a backup, and I had the quotes. So there's a scene where Morpheus is introducing Neo to the Matrix. And he tells him the Matrix is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth. And Neo asks, what truth? And Morpheus goes on, that you are a slave, Neo. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage, born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch, a prison for your mind. And then he offers him the blue pill and the red pill. Take the blue pill, you know, everything's fine. You go back being fat and happy and ignorant. You don't know different. Take the red pill. He says, I'll show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. You're gonna find out what real reality is. So he takes the red pill, as we all know, and then there's a scene, a few scenes later, where they're training him in the Matrix and how to interact, and Morpheus is lecturing Neo. The Matrix is a system, Neo. That system is our enemy. But when you're inside, you look around, what do you see? Businessmen, teachers, lawyers, carpenters, the very minds of the people we are trying to save. You have to understand, most of these people are not ready to be unplugged. And many of them are so inert, so hopelessly dependent on the system, that they will fight to protect it. I think that describes our culture, doesn't it, at some level? And one more reference here to the Matrix. How many of you remember Cypher? And what was Cypher's deal? He had taken the red pill, but he didn't want to fight anymore. He didn't care. He didn't want to, he didn't want to struggle. He didn't want the ascesis that the red pill offered. He wanted to return to being a blue pill. And so he's having this dinner with Agent Smith where they're discussing betraying the Nebuchadnezzar and the crew. And he goes, you know, I know that this steak doesn't exist. I know that when I put it in my mouth, the Matrix is telling my brain that it's juicy and delicious. After 9 years, you know what I realize? Ignorance is bliss. He doesn't care. He wants to take the blue pill. He wants the illusion over reality. How many Christians are like that today? Are we like that? Have we took the red pill, but do we live like blue pill people? We live in the world. We compromise. We're of the world. I think in our day, it's probably always been a challenge, but in our day, it is. I see a real concern out there in the Christian church today. But monasticism challenges the church not to take the blue pill. Okay, we've kicked that metaphor to death. Obedience and true freedom. Obedience is not a four-letter word. At least it was not for Benedict. It is for many in our culture. But the monastics saw obedience as trust in God's providence. It was the first step to humility in Benedict's rule. Of course, for the monks, they were to be obedient to their superior. How could we apply obedience to ourselves today? Who are we to be obedient to? Yeah, our authorities. Yeah, I mean, because that's part of God's providence. He places us in certain spheres of life where we have people over us. Paul even admonishes to be obedient to the secular authorities, for example. We're to be obedient to our spiritual authorities. Now, this is not some slavish, obedience. If someone obviously is leading you to do something wrong, you're not to follow that. But this idea of obedience challenges the contemporary views of freedom we have. The culture teaches us that freedom is the unfettered ability to indulge our impulses without accountability. Monasticism teaches us that the ability to submit to God and not indulge our impulses is true freedom. This is really counter to the culture, is it not? There's a wonderful quote in Thomas Merton's autobiography, Seven Story Mountain, that when he went into the monastery, he says, "Brother Matthew locked the gate behind me, and I was enclosed in the four walls of my new freedom." Just love that quote. So he's enclosed now. He's locked in, but now he's truly free. He took the red pill. Community, stability, and humility. The idea of community is a counter to the self-centeredness and individualism of our day. Now, God saves us as individuals, but we do not grow spiritually on our own. An old saying years ago, it takes a village. Well, it really takes a church for us to grow in grace. Stability. We talked about in Benedict's rule, the monks took a vow of stability. Joining the monastery was like getting married. You made a lifelong commitment. Why would you do that? When you're forced to live with people, you really have to grow, don't you? How many of you are married? Only us old guys wearing collars. We'll tell you, marriage is one of the hardest things you will ever do in many ways. It's very challenging because you have to live with this person. And there's a sort of ascesis of community that happens when you have to live with someone long term. You may have heard the statement, familiarity breeds contempt. Well, when you become very familiar with somebody, it is easy to be contemptuous of them because you see them in all their warts. The idea of hypocrisy comes from the Greek word to speak from behind a mask. And that's what a lot of us do. Let's be quite honest. We come to church or in other spheres of life, we put on masks. We mask we want other people to see. When you're committed to a community relationship with somebody over long periods of time, you cannot wear the mask. And think about that person who's the person you like the least, the most difficult person to get along with, maybe in the church, where you work, at school. That learning to get along with that person will probably teach you more about yourself than a whole room full of people whom you like and think are great. We have this phenomenon of church hopping today. And it's really I've talked to people who've left the church or other churches I've been involved in, and the reasons are often so very petty. Somebody offended them or looked at them wrong or whatever. But what does that say about them? You know, this idea of, what, you know, someone doesn't, you know, make you feel good or whatever, you're just going to up and leave. So anyway, this idea of community and stability is I think, a counter to that kind of mentality. This picture, let me say a few words about this. These monks are from the Benedictine Abbey of Worth in the United Kingdom. I hate reality TV. I just abhor it. I think it's the decline of Western civilization. But in 2005, 2006, the BBC put on a reality show called The Monastery. Has anybody seen this? It's fantastic. It's great reality TV. They took 40 modern Londoners and they put them in they took four, you know, contemporary guys from London, and they put them in a monastery for 40 nights or 40 days. And it was fascinating. I mean, and they actually have them going through spiritual education. They're going through the rounds. They each have a counselor, and it's wonderful stuff. It's great TV. You can go out and see this on the internet. I really encourage you. And it's very fascinating what happens to these guys. And there's some surprises there. Of course, they struggle. There's a couple of them. They just can't get along. And some of the lines of the abbot in this are just wonderful. You know, in fact, I've used some of them in my presentation. So they went on to make another one. I haven't seen all of it yet. Called The Big Silence. The Sabbath Christopher's kind of heads that up. It is very good stuff. If you get a chance, go and look for it. Just query the monastery BBC or something like that. Loosely, very not really. Some know. One's a skeptic, and he's actually the most surprising and interesting. Only really one of them is probably a Christian, and he's real into Buddhist theology. But anyway, I won't give anything away. You have to watch it and find out for yourselves. TV worth watching, perhaps. At least they're not about swamp people, you know, hunting gators or something. Okay, stillness and silence. This is a counter to our busy lives of perpetual distraction, and a counter to the endless deluge of the trivial. I think this is a real challenge, going to be a real challenge for us today, especially for you young people. How do you control the amount of technology that's being thrown at you, that you're consuming? Every study I hear or read about, it seems to be increasingly bad news for what all this consumerism and technology, adaptation of technology, is doing to us emotionally, mentally, with our relationships. I know there's some debate or whether if there is such a thing as a technology addiction. You know, psychologists apparently debating this, but I think, you know, there's definitely reasons to be concerned, and it's going to get worse. I work in the field of information technology, and there are some things on the horizon you have not seen anything yet. It's crazy what is coming down the pipe. There is something called quantum computing, which is now a reality. And you think the last 20 years have changed our world? You just wait to see what happens in the next, when quantum computing becomes commonplace. Just as an example, I gave a talk this week on encryption to some of our international folks who were in town in my day job. And in current computing power, to crack some of our present-day encryption that we have would essentially take, with our current computing power, to the age of the universe to crack. It's estimated that with quantum computing, you can crack that same level of encryption in seconds. So it's definitely going to be a brave new world. But how do we balance this? You know, you can't go out to eat anymore or go in public. I go to a restaurant. There's a TV on each wall. You know, you have families sitting there looking in different directions or they're looking at their devices. Well, something is terribly wrong. Living our theology, and we're close to wrapping up. The authentic Christian life is not just a way of thinking, but of being. This is a counter, I think, to the over-intellectualization of the faith we have in some Christian circles. And I came out of this sort of tradition where your faith was all about doctrinal, getting your doctrine right, you know, assenting to certain key doctrines, particularly around justification. I think it's also a counter to easy believism. And this is an area of great concern. I have many dear friends who have walked the aisle, prayed the prayer years ago. They've never darkened the door since. But they believe. They don't live lives of prayer. They don't go to church. They don't worship. There's nothing about them that is Christian. But if you ask them, are you Christian? Yes, I believe. Very concerning. And conversion of life. There's more to spiritual formation than right belief. Sort of related to the last point. Human beings are a unity of being, and we need a balanced and holistic ascesis that incorporates the whole person in the process of sanctification. We're just not a brain that needs to have our doctrine straight. We need to have our doctrine straight, but we also need to live lives that reflect the gospel. How many of you have ever taken martial arts? I used to do that years ago. Now, if I tried to do a move or a kick, you guys would have to call 911. But when we did martial arts, there's something you do over and over and over called a kata. Remember this? These forms you practice. Why do you do that? I hated it sometimes. It's just so boring. You know, teach me how to do the really cool stuff. But no, do the kata. Well, the idea here is you do this move repeatedly until you don't have to think about it. It becomes part of you. You just if someone ever jumps, you just react. They talk about spiritual muscle memory. And this is what the goal is for us, spiritually, I think, in conversion of life. It's forming a habitual recollection of the presence of God. It's spiritual muscle memory. I found a great quote that defines this habitual recollection. It's that spirit of faith which instinctively refers all things to God, that mentality which instinctively refuses the values of the world and sees things as they are in God's sight in relationship to Him. That's the goal, habitual recollection. How do we get there? Pray without ceasing. But how do we do that? This prayer is the single most important thing we Christians can do. Saint Benedict said, nothing comes before the divine office. I think the prayer tradition that we have in Anglicanism and in monasticism is a counter to the reductionist and utilitarian view of prayer that is very common in many circles. What do I mean by that? Well, reductionist, and I had this problem for many years myself in evangelical traditions, prayer for me was extemporaneous uttering, stream of consciousness words, and I could never do it well. I was very distracted. I could never pray. I spent years. I went to seminary. I got these advanced degrees. I didn't know how to pray, and it almost destroyed my faith. And I think other people have a very utilitarian view of prayer. You know, prayer is, you know, the genie in the bottle. If you rub it just right, you'll get God, the deity, to respond to you. Use the right words, the right formula. Stream enough words together. And now, prayer certainly is extemporaneous words. But that's not all it is, and that's one of the strengths of our tradition. Prayer is actually communion with God. It's to be a way of life. St. Basil tells us, this is how you pray continually, not by offering prayer in words, but by joining yourself to God through your whole way of life, so that your life becomes one continuous and uninterrupted prayer. Powerful stuff. That's how we build our spiritual muscle memory. Okay. Well, that's all I have. Any questions or comments?
even today's society, right now, just in history that we're living right now, we as Christians are constantly under attack by the secular society. We're being, it's they don't have an idea of what it is like, truly like, to be a Christian, or it's because we will not conform to their secularism. What, you know, other than living our Christian lives as living life as the life of Christ, you know, we're supposed to love those people as well, to try to turn their hearts. What is your best take on turning hearts of people, especially since we are individual like monastic in our lives, maybe not of that.
Yeah, so how do we, you know, if we're all kind of monastic, how do we reach the world, basically? It's interesting, the comment you made about, you know, barbarians. You know, Chuck Colson years ago wrote a book, Barbarians at the Gate, you know, talking about that same idea. But how do we reach the community? I think, you know, there's a book that Bishop Sutton had us read a few years ago, had his clergy read, called The Celtic Way of Evangelism. It's a great book. You know, I tried to do the whole, you know, get people to pray the prayer years ago. I was in the Navigators. I mean, I worked with those guys and went around, beat doors. Just never worked. Never. But what I've seen personally work over the years is building relationships with people. And it's a long process. You don't get them to pray a prayer and you're done. You walk away. You have to. It's a lifelong commitment, essentially, relationship building. And I've seen much more fruit evangelizing that way, and then trying to get people into the church. So I mean, that's any of you guys want to take a shot at that?
What was the specific question?
It's basically what we're going on. You see it every single day in the media or in general. It's one kid that was a valedictorian of his class.
Right.
He was talking about his Christian witness. The principal says, "You are not going to talk about that."
Right.
But he did it and said, "You are not going to tell me what I can't become professional. I am just because of my faith in God." Mm-hmm. Right. But it's happening all over the world. That it is shameful or it is evil to be Christ-like. And I'm seeing myself, I'm trying to find out, you know, I'm saying myself, you know, I'm pretty sure we're coming to a point in pretty close recent history or in the near future, there's going to be a lot of martyrdom going on if we truly stand up for our faith. Because eventually it's going to get to the point where those who, they're saying, okay, we can't nudge them, we're going to destroy them. You know, they try to destroy us by our socially, then it's an addition to get violent. You're seeing it going on in Egypt right now. You see it going all over the Middle East. Christians are being murdered left and right. But what I'm saying is that it happened, you know, by letting, you know, it happened with the life of Christ, but they see Christ in us. Okay? But we're just living in a society now where, like, if I talk to a friend of mine, we're talking about the Christ, and we're talking about this person next to you, can you shut up about God? I said, no, I can't shut up about God. So, but at least I know you're listening. Yeah. That shut him up.
Yeah. Okay. I think we just have to be obedient and faithful. I think part of the problem is the church collectively has not been, at least in the West. I was reading a story about one of these Americans who converted to Islam, became, you know, got into militant Islam. Well, he tried Christianity and found it wanting. There was no difference between the Christians he interacted with and the world, right? Islam offered him an alternative.
What you're describing really is the process of secularization. People, the human thing is that everyone's given up believing in God, which isn't the case. What's happened is secularization is giving up God in the public sphere. Saying, I have a personal belief, but I'm not going to speak his name in public. And all that answer is kind of what we're talking about, and that is to have a community of faith that stands up and says, we're willing to be countercultural and pay the cost. And one of the questions is, are we more likely to die by persecution, which is kind of the 1984 version, Or maybe what's killed us more is the Brave New World, where at Selma we've got all of these things that are really distractors. That's kind of what's killed the church in one sense. We allow ourselves to be abused to death, which of course paves the way for it. We have to stand up as a separate community and say, we're Christians, not Americans. We're also Americans. That's true. We have a secondary citizenship, but we're primarily Christians and not
Mm-hmm. Well, Brave New World 1984 and Animal Farm are happening right now. I mean, I don't know if you remember, but if you haven't read this, then you gotta read because it's happening in this society.
Well, 1984 just shut up the sales the last week.
I think it's time to go to lunch, guys, so let's go ahead and end that there. Thank you very much for your attendance.